preparing only fresh, all-natural, non-processed ingredients in wood-fired ovens. Taking pizza orders from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Thursday, and 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Friday and Saturday. Phone 217-530-4137 and online at anticachampagne.com.
This is you're listening to WEFT Champagne. It's exactly noon, and this is a new program. It's called The World We Live In. It's going to be, or I'm going to be doing, talking about things like politics, kind of feature stories, and basically kind of, you know, what's going on in the country with politics and other world events, and I have a guest with me. He's a professor at the University of Illinois. He's a photography professor. He does, what would you say you do? Your name is Charles Stretch Ledford?
Yeah, that's correct. So Charles Ledford, born with a different middle name, but my first day of college at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in 1981, some joker marked through Charles on the name tag door on the dorm room and wrote Stretch, and here we are 10 years later. And I teach visual journalism at the University of Illinois.
You started doing photography in the 80s, I believe, or sometime?
Yeah, technically it would have been in the 1970s. I think I was 16, which would have been 79, I guess. And I got a camera, a 35mm camera, a Canon AT1 for Christmas. And my first subject was our family hamster, Hampy. Hampy, the family hamster, was my first portrait subject, actually.
And you've been doing photography ever since.
Yes. So yeah. I shot pictures for the yearbook in high school just for fun, and had aspirations of going to medical school or some such other respectable profession. But my grades at Carolina weren't good enough for medical school, and then I saw an ad in the Daily Tar Heel, the student newspaper, analogous to the Daily Illini. For a photographer. And I thought, wow, this sounds fun. I've done photography in high school and we'll give it a try. I had no idea that there was anything called photojournalism or a career possible as a photojournalist or a photographer, but I started shooting newspapers for the Daily Tar Heel. And thank God, doors opened, and here we are. See, how many years later? 30 years later, and 54 countries later. And one assistant professorship later, so it's all grown from there.
Yeah, you've been featured in many publications such as The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal. You've been NBC News, CNN. I mean, we can kind of go on. What is it that kind of gives you that, in terms of your practice? I guess you say I had a photography professor. From my days of college, he said, the only better way to get better at photography is basically just keep taking pictures.
Absolutely.
Is there, would you say there's anyone else, like in terms of using lighting, maybe a different camera?
There are different tools. Serious photographers who are working with intention to tell a story or make a statement with their camera. We have a lot of tools that we can use. Some tools are different types of cameras, an iPhone versus a 35mm or a wide-angle lens versus a telephoto, or a different equipment, different tools. I was going to say video versus stills. That was the other thing I was trying to remember in our toolbox. So we have these technical toolbox, but we also have a toolbox of creative tools, and those include the use of light, an anticipation of a decisive moment that one could capture as a photographer, a sense of composition, an innate, somehow, or trained maybe sense that as you look through the viewfinder, that something looks right or it doesn't look right. It falls into place, and there's a harmony there that has allowed us to use our tool, our technical tool, in a creative way, cut through the chaos, the visual chaos of the world around us, and to make sense of it, not only in a visual sense, in a graphic sense, in an aesthetic sense, but also in terms of interpreting something as a journalist, interpreting something that we're experiencing and seeing it as a truth that can be shared with other people. So,
yeah, I looked at some of your research. You talked about how, you know, photography is a way to provide a pathway for that deeper self to recognize connectedness it shares with the other. And by the other, do you mean like basically other people, the spectator, the other people,
you know, the ontological other, the other selves, that the other souls that make up this experience that we're having here in this particular time and particular place. And there was a photographer, and his name is escaping me now, but a great documentary photographer, early documentary photographer, said, the job of photography is to explain man to man and explain every man to himself. So explain people to one another and explain photographers to ourselves. And that's, I think, what I'm building on or amplifying or alluding to in the statement you read, that when we make photographs with intention, they share, we share that intentionality through the photograph with another group of people or another person, anyone who's different, who's not ourselves, a different self, that the content and message of that photograph ideally makes a connection with the viewer, that other, and somehow, if not builds bridges, at least opens pathways of possible pathways for possible understanding, something like that. Yeah.
Were there any photos that you saw when you were young that kind of got you into photography?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, and it's ironic because as I was when I was a young photographer and I was learning about how the great photographers got involved, or how other photographers, I should say, my generation got involved in photography. Often it was by seeing photographs in Life magazine, you know, maybe from the Vietnam War, photographs in the National Geographic during the 70s, 60s or 70s, or the newspaper, the local newspaper. But I grew up in a little town, Asheville, North Carolina, and it was back then pretty much a backwater. It was the last town, if you're heading west, in western North Carolina before it becomes, you know, impassable mountain. I mean, they're passable, but mountainous, a real hillbilly kind of country. And I say that with all due respect because that's where my daddy's people are from, and we're all, you know, just a bunch of hillbillies. But they ended up settling there in Asheville. But it was this sort of backwater. And I never saw Time magazine. I never saw Life magazine or National Geographic, or and our newspaper wasn't one that used photographs in a way that would garner anyone's attention. And so that's why, like, going into college and when I first started making pictures for the Daily Tar Heel, it was like a light bulb went off, and you know, you can do this. You can make photographs, and then them show up really big and you know, reproduce nicely in a newspaper the next day, the Daily Tar Heel, that 20,000 people might see. And then there are other newspapers that do this, and there are magazines, and there's a career path for people who want to make photographs, and specifically make photographs of people and of the world around them. And once I discovered that that thing, photojournalism, existed, that was a light bulb. I was like, so this is why I'm on this planet, right? This is what I'm supposed to do. But no, I can't say there was any early, like, you know, primordial in my, you know, kind of formative, before my formative years as a photographer, but as a, you know, my formative years as a, you know, kid, that there were photographs that influenced me. I could, you know, probably not, which is sort of odd in a way.
And as you said, you've been quite a bit all around the world, parts of like Indonesia, and then really isolated countries. And can you like, is there any experiences that kind of stand out? Or I mean, I'm sure there are, but
yeah,
is there
any? Yeah. Well, Indonesia we go to pretty often because my lovely wife is from Indonesia, so we go back once a year, once every 2 years, and so. But other places, I mean, most of West Africa, much of East Africa, some of Southeast Asia, the former Soviet Union, China, Cambodia. Well, I guess that's Southeast Asia, but most continents, what are there? 8 continents, 7 continents. How many continents are there? 7?
At least six.
Anyway, but I've been to all but one. I've not been to all but two. I've not been to Australia or Antarctica. But yeah, some pretty far flung places.
And I just kind of, you got to actually be take pictures or be in Ronald Reagan's presidential or is the White House.
Or yeah.
What was that one?
Yeah. So I actually photographed Reagan twice, as I recall. The first time I was in college, and maybe I was a junior in college or something, or it might have been right after I graduated college, but I was in D.C., and I went, somehow I made connection with the White House photographer whose name escapes me now, and I'm sorry that I can't remember it. I should, but this was back in the 80s. But the White House photographer for U.S. News and World Report. And, you know, he knew I was interested in photojournalism, and I guess maybe, I don't know if he'd seen any of my work. Maybe I'd showed him my portfolio. But somehow I had gotten in touch with him and stayed in touch. I think we met at a conference of some sort. He said, next time you're in D.C., you know, come see me. I'll take you on a shoot. So it turns out the shoot that day, I went up and called him up, and the shoot that day was German Chancellor Helmut Kohl coming for a state visit, and so we were in the White House. I don't remember really anything about the White House press room or the pen there, or where, you know, the place where we waited and before we went to the Oval Office. I think we were outside, actually, as a matter of fact. In fact, I know we were outside. They had done something in the, I guess, the Rose Garden or the back lawn there, and photographed that. And then they went into the Oval Office, and, you know, I'm like this 23-year-old kid, and I'm with these, you know, major news magazine photographers. And anyway, they huddle us in, and they're, you know, I'm in the Oval Office of all places, and Cole and Reagan are sitting there, and we're snapping, you know, doing our thing. And you know, the U.S. News and World Report photographer let me, you know, got me a pass and everything, so I could go in and just photograph as if I was part of the media. So I made those photographs, and I still have them. But what I really regret is that I didn't take a really good look around at that room. You know, all I remember about the Oval Office was is the fireplace and these two guys sitting there. And I really wish I had turned around and kind of gotten a feel for it, you know, because I can't imagine it'll ever happen again. And then Reagan was down in, I worked for the St. Petersburg Times for 3 years after college and as a photojournalist. And now the Tampa Bay Times. And Reagan had gone down to a Naval Air Station in Jacksonville for a memorial. The USS Stark had taken a torpedo and in an isolated incident out in the Gulf of the Persian Gulf or somewhere out in the Middle East. Anyway, So he came in for a memorial service for the soldiers that were lost, and had a photograph from much, much, much farther away. It was it was in an auditorium, 300, 400 millimeter lens. And he had made a speech, and then he and Nancy Reagan were going around and hugging the family members, and got a nice little photo of Reagan, you know, comforting this the wife of this deceased soldier. But so yeah, once close up and personal, as far as I am away from you, and then once you know, on the other side of a football stadium.
And of course, in your you've also taken pictures of the Mother Teresa, and it's, I believe, in an earthquake.
Yeah. So that was in a complete, you know, the one great thing about this business and this way of life, this craft, I guess I should say, is the serendipities that you experience, you know, stuff you never would have imagined. And I was also working for the St. Pete Times. This was in 89. Soviet Armenia, then the Soviet Republic of Armenia, had experienced a devastating earthquake on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day of 1989, and it was a terrible thing. And there was a Shriners Hospital in Tampa, which is a sister city to St. Pete, where the newspaper was based, and the Shriners Hospital orthopedic clinic there paid to bring over from Armenia in the weeks after the earthquake some families, five maybe children and their parents, and to rehabilitate the kids, fit them with prosthetic limbs, especially legs, and in doing so, give these folks from an undeveloped Soviet, country with no economy in general, but not because it was Soviet Union, but also coming out of this earthquake zone, give them an opportunity to see America. And things like, you know, I have a photograph of them in Tampa, one of the ladies walking through a shoe store in a mall, and it's all glitzy and glittery. And, you know, coming from where she came from, you don't go to a store and have like 300 pairs of shoes to choose from. So a reporter named David Finkel, who now works for the Washington Post and has won a Pulitzer or maybe two, David came up with this idea that, you know, let's do a story, he wanted to do a story on these children as they experienced Western medical care, the families as they experienced Western economies, and both all of them as they experienced Western ways, to do a story on the contrast between that and then when they went back to Soviet Armenia. So David and I photographed and he wrote about them while their experience in Tampa. And then they went back to Armenia, and a couple weeks later, he and I flew over there and tracked them down and photographed and wrote about their experience there in Armenia and how their experience in America had changed them. Anyway, very long story. And I haven't. What was this about Mother Teresa? So we are at a somewhere in Armenia, in a cemetery, as I recall, or maybe not. But it was somewhere in Armenia amidst this devastation. And there are a lot of relief groups from various places that show up in situations like this. And what I remember is it being in this crowd and it seemed important coming up because there were guys in suits that were kind of clearing the way, which wasn't something you saw there at that time. And lo and behold, there comes this little hunched over Yoda-like figure in a, you know, white outfit, you know, shawl with blue stripes on it, and it's Mother Teresa, and she's handing out some sort of medals. I'm not Catholic. I should know just as a journalist, but I think they were St. Christopher medals, but they were St. somebody medals, and she was handing them out, and I got one, and somewhere I have that from 1989. I have no idea where it is, but yeah, so photograph Mother Teresa. It was a complete one-off, you know. I mean, it was like, here she is, make some pictures, and then...
Did she say anything, or...?
Nah, she was mumbling something, you know, to the children or to the people. You know, she was paying attention to the victims of the earthquake. But, and she, I'm sure she was used to having press around her, so, you know.
I don't want to keep you too long, but you had this one project that I thought was really interesting. It was called The Overtown Neighborhood, and it was in, takes place in, or the photos are in Miami. It's this kind of, this, I don't know how you describe it, neighborhood kind of, I don't know if you...
Yeah. So Overtown, Overtown Inside Out is what it was called. And that project I did while I was in Miami at the University of Miami as a graduate student. I went back to grad school in 2009 as a 46-year-old to get my master's in multimedia. And with the plan of moving away from freelance photography, which I've been doing since 93, and moving toward digital multimedia and with the goal specifically of getting a tenure track teaching position, which thankfully it has happened. I'm on tenure track here at the U of I, a wonderful place to be. And but it's so in 2009, I'm working my master's at the University of Miami, and we needed a master's capstone project, of course. And I never heard of Overtown until one day during class, our professor, Rich Beckman, who actually, ironically, another serendipity, happened to be my first photojournalism teacher in 1983 at the University of North Carolina, 40 years previous. But he had asked us, the various students, 8 or 10 of us, to put together postcards of different neighborhoods of Miami, a visual postcard. So there was South Beach, and there was different areas of Miami that the tourist culture, different ideas of, and aspects of Miami that people were photographing and concentrating on for a week or two. And someone mentioned Overtown, and nobody who was familiar with Miami wanted to go into Overtown. It was like, ah, no way, man, I'm not going to go there. And I found out that it's that Overtown is one of those communities that, because it's poor, because it's mostly black, because it is undeveloped and rather than having been redeveloped as much of Miami had been, but because it's poor, because it's black, and people don't go there. You know, you drive through Overtown, you lock your doors. That's the way it was perceived. Or you drive over on the interstates over the community of Overtown because you don't have to drive through the streets of Overtown. And so I heard that and I thought, oh man, that's where I want to go. You know, sounds like Jesse James said, somebody asked him allegedly, why do you rob banks? And he said, that's where the money is. And why do you go to somewhere like Overtown? Because that's where the stories are, you know? And the story in Overtown to me was that it was really dissed by much of the community of Miami as neighborhoods like that are across the country, across the world. And it was, there was a narrative that about Overtown in the popular media and in the culture down there, that it was a terrible place where people were shot and where drug deals happened and where, you know, nothing good came out of Overtown. And I found that to be disturbing and knew that it was false, and just based on my experience in other communities like Overtown. So I started shooting videos in Overtown to try and show the side of Overtown that isn't portrayed, wasn't portrayed in the popular media, and show people there living gracefully through hard times. So I moved into Overtown. I spent several weeks living there. I think probably a couple months, 8 weeks or so altogether. Lived and shot videos of the people in Overtown. And I wanted to make sure that as I did this, that I wasn't just another middle-class white grad student, you know, parachuting in from Coral Gables, a very wealthy part of Miami where the University of Miami is, but parachuting in from my world into theirs and then, leaving and taking these images and these stories. I wanted to make sure that I was making the images and making the stories, but I wasn't taking them with me when I left. I mean, I was taking them with me, but I also wanted to make sure that I was leaving something there, including the people of Overtown and their stories. So in a place like Overtown, there's no broadband access, or not a lot, and it's slow. So you couldn't just put them up on the web and assume people, put the stories on the web and assume people were going to see them. So I hacked together some what I called interactive multimedia kiosks, and had four of these things. One we put in a barbecue joint, one in a corner store, one in a barbershop, and one in a laundromat. And on these kiosks, they had a touch screen on them, and people could watch the videos. I would post the videos onto the kiosks as they were made. Videos, short 2 to 3 minute films focusing on maybe a person or maybe an event, you know, in Overtown. People could watch them, and it had the kiosks had cameras built in, had webcams built in. So as they watched the videos, after a video would play, there would be a series of questions pop up on the screen. How does watching this video make you feel about Overtown? Should this be shared outside of Overtown? What is another story? What's the next chapter in the story of Overtown that I should look at as a filmmaker? So the idea was to include the people of Overtown as co-producers, in a way, of the project, and it was quite successful. It was really interesting to hear people's response to videos, to stories that maybe didn't make their neighborhood, you know, it didn't sugarcoat any of the roughness of the neighborhood. But people nevertheless were proud of their neighborhood. They wanted the films, almost unanimously wanted the films to be shown outside of Overtown. And it was an attempt to allow my subjects to have some sort of voice in the product that would feature them, which is an unusual thing to have, and doesn't usually happen. So it was nice to have that opportunity.
And the last thing, you've been teaching at University of Illinois since.
Oh my god!
Yeah, you've been teaching at the University of Illinois since 2011.
Correct. I came in as an assistant professor of journalism in August of 2011. I teach Intro to Multimedia Storytelling, Journalism 215. I teach some independent studies, more advanced classes. We work on longer-term projects, things like the underrepresentation of African Americans in the STEM field, looking at that issue through the lens of the College of Engineering here. We are just now working with a group of students from Aeronautical Engineering on a grant from NASA. The Aeronautical Engineering students are designing, building, and NASA is going to launch a CubeSat, a very small satellite, a new class of satellites. They're going to launch that. NASA is going to launch it, or SpaceX, I think, is going to launch it for NASA next fall. And I've got a group of students that are working on telling the story of the process of discovery that the engineering students are going through as they build something that's actually going to go into space, you know, for the first time. Wow. So the advanced classes do, you know, more kind of long-term, complex things like that. And but I also teach intro students. All right.
All right. Well, I think that's... We've talked about a lot. So, all right. With that said, thank you so much, Professor Ledford.
Ledford, just call me Stretch. Everybody calls me Stretch.
All right, fair enough. Well, we're gonna go play.
Thank you for having me. Sure. I really enjoyed this a lot. And sure, I want to say this is my first time at this radio station, and I am blown away. These guys, gentle listeners, these guys have more CDs here than I've ever seen in one place at one time.
It's like a library of CDs.
It's not like a library. It's like a cornucopia of sound. And I am a new fan. I haven't even listened to your station, but I am a new fan, and I'm going to be tuning in. So, yeah, this is great.
All right. Well, with that said, I'm going to we'll play a song from Duke Ellington, the 1952 Seattle concert. I believe it's track number 4, Perdido.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and the Living Yoga Center. Established in 1995, the Living Yoga Center offers yoga classes, educational opportunities, and service. This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and the Living Yoga Center. Established in 1995, the Living Yoga Center offers yoga classes, educational opportunities, and services that promote a healthy, balanced, and spiritual lifestyle. The Sanctuary, located at 212...
Co-writer of Caravan introduces the melody of Caravan.
Thank you.
that was let's see, what was it? Magic Sam, Sweet Home Chicago on the blue. The Rough Guide to Chicago Blues. Next up, we're playing a song from the album. I believe it's Louis Prima Jr. Louis Prima Jr. His album Blow, and I believe the song. Well, I believe the song is called Blow.
Straight razor fell out of her purse. Oh. carry pistols too.
I apologize. That was actually Magic Sam, Sweet Home Chicago by the Rough Guide to Chicago Blues. The song that's about to play now is Blow by Louis Prima Jr.
Hey, Marco.
Yep.
Why don't you play that number you've been working on, man?
All right.
Okay, everybody ready to go? I'm just gonna blow.
Definitely wasn't anything wrong with that. That was again Blow by Louis Prima Jr. And I also just wanted again to say thank you to Professor Charles Ledford for coming by and telling me that incredible, you know, about his incredible work that he's done, you know, as a photographer. I think it's really interesting when you get to talk to people around this area, you know, with a university, because you get to meet a lot of interesting people, a lot of with a diverse background. And I would just also like to say the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WFT Champaign, Prairie Air Inc., the station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. And just once again, if you're wondering what show you listen to, this is a new kind of starting show called The World We Live In, and my name is Ben Theobald, and I'm will probably be hosting this show and kind of just trying to make sense, I guess, of kind of like how Professor Ledford said of the world, this kind of fascinating place we live in, and with what's going on, because it seems that you look at the news and sometimes it's just hard to kind of truly understand just from, but when you get to talk to people, I feel like it makes maybe makes a little bit more sense. With that said, I'm going to play a song from Nina Simone's album, The Blues. I believe it's, let's see, it's Day and Night, I believe it's. Apologize again. That was another song from Blow from Louis Prima Jr. That was Go Let's Go. Now I believe I got it set up right. This should be House The House of the Rising Sun by Nina Simone.
In New Orleans, call it the Rising Sun, and it's been the run of many poor girls. Me, oh Lord, I'm one. If I listen to what my mama said, be at home today, being so young and foolish, my Lord, let a gambler lead me astray. My mother, the tailor.
I'm Ben Theobald. You've been listening to The World We Live In on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and you can stream us online at weft.org. And yeah, that's it for me. I'll hopefully be here next week, and next I'll be playing my song from Corey Reed's Let's Groove, the music of Earth, Wind, and Fire. I believe it's track number 9, After the Love Is Gone.